jacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor. No blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is. Maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Not certainly not, and certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's why they did it. That's why they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one. Because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. They must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesia, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating. Physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar, but there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things to go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. Yeah. They tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blocked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney has said that several GOP members of Congress had voted against impeaching former U.S. President Donald Trump out of fear for their own lives. We now present you an article written jointly by Gloria Oladipo and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Liz Cheney Says McCarthy Should Testify About Trump's Views on Capital Attack. The article has been published by the new British newspaper The Guardian. Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney said on Friday, 14th of May, that the U.S. Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy should testify before the commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol attack because he has said publicly that he's got information about the president's state of mind on that day. House Democrats and Republicans have agreed to create a bipartisan commission to investigate the Capitol riot. However, the terms of the proposed commission fell short of Republican demands, casting doubt on whether the GOP will vote for its creation. Recently, Kevin McCarthy presided over the ejection of Liz Cheney from Republican House leadership over her refusal to back Donald Trump's lie that his election defeat by Joe Biden was the result of mass electoral fraud and the role of that lie in stoking the attack on Congress. Speaking to ABC News' This Week program in an interview to be broadcast in the coming days, Liz Cheney said, McCarthy absolutely should testify before any commission and that she wouldn't be surprised if he were subpoenaed. As agreed by the Democratic chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, and the ranking Republican John Katko of New York, the commission would have subpoena power if its Democratic-appointed chair and Republican-appointed vice chair agree, or if a majority of the evenly split 10-person panel voted in favor. The panel would be modeled on the 9/11 Commission, which was created in late 2002 and published its report in 2004. A vote on the National Commission to Investigate the 6th of January Attack on the United States Capitol Complex Act, legislation necessary to create the panel, could happen as early as next week. Kevin McCarthy did not immediately back the deal. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi proposed a commission in February, but the process stalled. Democrats wanted the commission to focus solely on the 6th of January riot and attack. Republicans wanted to include violence during protests over police brutality last summer, which they attribute to left-wing groups. There was also disagreement about the makeup of the commission and its subpoena powers. Thompson was asked to negotiate with Katko, like Cheney, one of 10 House Republicans who voted for Donald Trump's impeachment on a charge of inciting an insurrection. Donald Trump was not convicted, as only 7 Republican senators voted to do so. Should the commission be formed, it would only investigate the events of 6th of January. 5 members, including the chair, would be selected by Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. 5 members, including a vice chair, would be appointed by Kevin McCarthy and the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Current government employees would not be appointed. The members would have significant expertise in the areas of law enforcement, civil rights, civil liberties, privacy, intelligence, and cybersecurity. A final report will be required outlining facts and causes and providing recommendations to prevent future attacks. Authorities are still examining videos and photographs from 6th of January. Told by Donald Trump to fight like hell, hundreds of his supporters broke into the Capitol. Some looked for lawmakers, including Donald Trump's Vice President Mike Pence, to capture and possibly to kill. 5 people actually died during the riots. More than 440 people have been arrested in connection with the attack and charged with crimes including use of deadly or dangerous weapon and assaulting a police officer. Prosecutors have said they expect to charge about 100 more individuals. Kevin McCarthy spoke to Donald Trump as the attack proceeded. Jaime Herrera Butler, a Washington State Republican, has said Kevin McCarthy told her that when he asked the president to call his supporters off, Donald Trump replied, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." In a recent interview on Fox News Channel, Kevin McCarthy, who has aligned his party firmly with Donald Trump, avoided questions about Butler's statement, but did not deny it. Liz Cheney told ABC News, "I would hope he doesn't require a subpoena, but I wouldn't be surprised if he were subpoenaed." Announcing his deal with Katko, Thompson said, "There has been a growing consensus that the January 6th attack is of a complexity and national significance that what we need is an independent commission to investigate." Nancy Pelosi said, "It is imperative that we seek the truth of what happened on 6th of January with an independent bipartisan 9/11 type commission to examine and report upon the facts, causes and security relating to the terrorist mob attack." Liz Cheney said, "The elements of that commission are exactly as they should be. I'm very glad they rejected Leader McCarthy's suggestions that somehow we should dilute the commission. It's really important that it will be focused on just 6th of January and the events leading up to it." Liz Cheney, a hardline conservative, is a daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney and a member of the Republican establishment. But she has been replaced in House leadership by Elise Stefanik, a New York backed by Donald Trump. "Liz Cheney said her rejection was dangerous. I think that we have to recognize how quickly things can unravel. We have to recognize what it means for the nation to have a former president who has not conceded and who continues to suggest that our electoral system cannot function, cannot do the will of the American people." She also said she regretted voting for Donald Trump. She said, "I was never going to support Joe Biden, and I do not regret the vote." She added, "It was a vote based on policy, based on substance, and in terms of the kinds of policies he put forward that were good for the country. But I think it's fair to say that I regret the vote." Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney has also said that several GOP members of Congress had voted against impeaching Donald Trump out of fear for their own lives. The Wyoming member of the House of Representatives told CNN on Friday, 14th of May, "For example, if you look at the vote to impeach, there were members who told me that they were afraid for their own security, afraid in some instances for their own lives," she added, "and that tells you something about where we are as a country, that members of Congress aren't able to cast votes, or feel that they can't, because of their own security." Donald Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives a historic second time for the instigation of the January storming of U.S. Capitol. On 6th of January, Donald Trump incited his own supporters, including members of the Proud Boys, to storm the Capitol building, where lawmakers were in the process of confirming President-elect Joe Biden's win in the 2020 presidential election. Liz Cheney was one of only 10 House Republicans who voted to hold Donald Trump accountable for the Capitol violence. She has refuted Donald Trump's claim that the 2020 election was stolen from him, in turn sparking fierce backlash from Donald Trump, who advocated for Cheney to be removed from her leadership position in the House of Representatives. On Wednesday, 12th of May, Republican lawmakers dumped Cheney from her House leadership post, underscoring the hold the twice-impeached former president retains on his political party. Liz Cheney has said she will do everything in her power to keep Donald Trump from winning the presidency should he decide to run again in 2024. She said recently, "I will do everything I can to ensure that the former president never again gets anywhere near the Oval Office." She added, "We have seen the danger that he continues to provoke with his language. We have seen his lack of commitment and dedication to America's Constitution. And I think it's very important that we make sure whomever we elect is somebody that will be faithful to the Constitution." Moreover, she has warned her fellow GOP members against joining former U.S. President Donald Trump's crusade to undermine America's democracy. Liz Cheney said in a fiery floor speech on the eve of her ouster from House GOP leadership, she said, "Every one of us who has sworn the oath must act to prevent the unraveling of our democracy. This is not about policy. This is not about partisanship. This is about our duty as Americans." She also reiterated that Donald Trump's insistence on his previous positions regarding questioning the legitimacy of the U.S. President Joe Biden's victory would endanger the country's democratic processes. Liz Cheney noted, "Remaining silent and ignoring the lie emboldens the liar," adding, "I will not participate in that. I will not sit back and watch in silence while others lead our country down a path that abandons the rule of law and joins the former president's crusade to undermine our democracy." She further warned that Donald Trump's actions threatened more violence, like the 6th of January insurrection and rioting. Liz Cheney said, "Today we face a threat America has never seen before. A former president who provoked a violent attack at the Capitol in an effort to steal the election has resumed his aggressive effort to convince the American public that the election was indeed stolen from him." Liz Cheney added, "He risks inciting further violence."
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, today marks the 73rd anniversary of the Nakba. This is the day of the catastrophe when an entity was created called Israel and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were thrown off of their land and many were killed. Since May of 1948 until now, Palestinians continue to be under attack by the Israeli regime. And now in 2021, the regime has launched even more aggression against Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied territories. But this time around, the resistance is also launching offensives against the regime. We're going to start this debate off by crossing over to Ramallah and talking to correspondent there, Mona Candil. Mona, thanks so much for being with us, and of course you've been with us all day, and now it is in the evening and night. Fill us in on what has taken place today overall.
Yes, as you were saying, it's the 73rd anniversary of the Palestinians' catastrophe, their Nakba. Palestinians held rallies across the occupied West Bank to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their home by the Israeli Zionist militias that in order to create what's known today as Israel, when an estimated 700,000 Palestinians were forced out from their homes and from their lands. Following the demonstration that took place in Ramallah, Palestinians marched toward the outskirts of the city on the way to the northern entrance of Al Biri city, where the Israeli military checkpoint of Beit Il and Beit Il settlement and Beit Il military checkpoint. Clashes took place between the Palestinian protesters and the Israeli forces, who fired, starting by heavy tear gas and rubber-coated bullets in order to disperse the protesters. We are speaking about 180 Palestinians were wounded today, according to reports by the Palestinian Ministry of Health. 180 Palestinians were wounded, of course, across the occupied West Bank, because other protests took place all around the occupied West Bank. Palestinians, of course, today also took part in the funeral processions of a number of Palestinians were killed by the Israeli forces yesterday, Friday. These protests had taken place in the occupied West Bank to denounce Israel's massacres and airstrikes against the besieged Gaza Strip.
All right, thank you so much for that update from Ramallah. And now I'd like to welcome my other guests to this debate. Journalist and documentary filmmaker Yusuf Al-Halu out of London and editor of NewFrontierUSA.org. Angelo John Gage out of New Jersey. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in London. And Yusuf, now, Israel has been blatant with its attacks as usual, whether we're talking about raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the month of Ramadan or stealing more Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah or its massive attacks on Gaza. The regime acts with impunity. Why is that the case? I mean, is it just because they really believe that they can get away with it, or actually they just don't care?
It's all of that, Marzia. It's because Israel knows it will not be held accountable for its atrocities that is ongoing, the ethnic cleansing that started in 1948, the evicting of those 50 Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem, the attacks against peaceful Muslim worshippers. It was the turning point. I call it a turning point because of the awakening that it sent shockwaves across the region, across the world, to say that, look, Palestinians have been under Israeli military occupation, under oppression for decades, and the world is allowing this to happen. And clearly it's because of the blind American support, the U.S. administrations, whether it's Obama, Biden, Trump, they are all the same, different faces for the same currency. Gaza has been under bombardment for the sixth consecutive day. 140 Palestinians have been killed, including some 40 children. Massive destruction was caused entire buildings, high-rise buildings, were destroyed during live on air. Media offices were attacked. The world is watching. It's a double standard policy. It's a hypocrisy. It's an international conspiracy of silence. They consider Palestinian a blood cheap. They blame always on the Palestinian side. The Western media always portrays the Palestinians as the victimizers. The first thing they ask you, why rockets are fired from Gaza. They don't ask you what's the cause of the latest escalation in Gaza. They consider Palestinians as subhumans, unfortunately. But despite all this biased stance, we see the huge solidarity demonstrations across the globe, whether it's in Europe or elsewhere.
Okay.
People are awakening. So there is mass mobilization on part of the nations, and now it's up to the governments of the so-called international community, the so-called democratic countries, to act, intervene, and put pressure on Israel to stop its genocide, ethnic cleansing, and to act a country, to act as a country under international
okay.
law, not above the international law.
All right, I turn to New Jersey. Let me get Angelo in on this conversation. Now, there have been massive protests, as Yusuf just alluded to, around the world condemning Israel, and videos of the atrocities that the regime is committing in Gaza shared widely on social media. Do you see this as a transition? Do you think that more and more people not only are becoming aware, but have a sense of responsibility to do something this time around?
Yes, I do believe more and more people are becoming aware, which is why we're seeing internet censorship of all sorts of activists across the world, I myself included in those hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are deeply disturbed about the actions that Israel takes. It is genocide, as Yusuf said. It's been going on for nearly seven decades, and they always try to blame the Palestinians for it. Oh, these rockets are coming for all they're because they're evil. Why did this all start? Well, it's because of Nakba. And the people of the world are watching Israel. And all the excuses that the U.S., my country, is making for them, people are no longer buying. In fact, there are several Rashid Tlaib was saying something very passionate about it. They're asking people to at least hold Israel accountable to human rights, to the Geneva Conventions, to do something. And so this pressure on Israel will continue to grow. I hope it does continue to grow. I am glad people around the world are unified together for the Palestinian people, because this is nothing short of a genocide. We are seeing children being killed, civilians. Israelis are saying that, oh, we got them to get into the tunnels, yet they're still bombing high-rises and taking out the media, blowing up children, entire families, with no repercussions because of the undying, unbreakable bond that my country has with the Israelis, who have harmed my country as well, with the USS Liberty, Jonathan Pollard, and all the other things that they have done to us. So I do see a trend of people waking up across the world. I am happy to see that, but I do not want to see anyone else dying until people wake up. I want them to wake up now and to take action now, because now is the time to make this change.
Well, Yusuf, speaking of change, there seems to be a change this time around with the Palestinian situation, in that the resistance itself is making the Israelis pay a price this time around for their aggression. Your take on that?
Well, yes, the Israelis were taken by surprise that the capabilities of the Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza are much, much stronger than the 2014, the last unallowed aggression on Gaza. They are surprised because they ask themselves this question. And a small organization under siege for the past 13 years, how on earth it managed to improve its capabilities and advance its training, tactics and strategies, and how it was able to reach areas such as Tel Aviv or Ben Gurion Airport, or even areas inside the Green Line. So they know that whenever they attack Gaza, they leave Gaza, they destroy Gaza, and then after some years they will come attack Gaza, because they know they will not achieve victory. Because everybody is united now behind the resistance, because they don't differentiate between a Hamas fighter or a civilian. The vast majority of those who were maimed and killed are civilians. If you see the footage of those children torn to pieces and those who were pulled from under the rubble, the tons of bombs that were dropped on Gaza, pounding Gaza day and night, relentless airstrikes, tank shelling, warships attacking, it was like an action movie. 2 million people have been experiencing terror and fear. Let's call it. It's people of Gaza have been terrorized by Israel's weapons and advanced technologies. Although they know that these civilians' areas, they justify this by telling you it was rockets fired from within these civilian areas. They intentionally, as everybody agrees, they attack these targets so that they inflict heavy damage so that the Palestinians revolt against the resistance and accuse it. But I can tell you, it's the opposite is happening. Everyone is united behind the resistance because Israel, as I said, they attack everybody. I mean,
let me just jump in here, Yusuf, what you've just said. Everyone is united behind the resistance, that side of things, because the Palestinians in general, the people, along with the various resistance groups, seem to be one this time around. Do you agree with that analysis? And if so, what has happened? What brought on this change?
Well, they've been always united, the resistance groups. They formed a joint chamber of
with Oman. With the people, too.
Yeah. I mean, if Israel is doing its best to disconnect Palestinians between Gaza, the West Bank in 1948, the Arab world, but whenever Israel attacks Gaza in this lethal manner, disproportionate force, the destruction and the killing and the horror, people are showing sympathy with their fellow citizens, whether they are in the West Bank or inside historic Palestine, because they cannot just sit idle and watch without any intervening. Even the Palestinian Authority stance, which is obviously it's much better than previous years. The Palestinian president said Israel crossed or red lines. He said Jerusalem is a red line. He's allowing demonstrations to be staged across the occupied West Bank. So they are united because this time it's different, and it's different because Israel is attacking a holy site. It's attacking Jerusalem, Al-Quds. It's evicting this round of escalation. It was not between Hamas ruled Gaza and Israel. No, it was initiated because of Israel's attacks on Al-Quds, on Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And Al-Quds unites all Palestinians.
Okay, well, Angelo, in Paris now, the French government, because we've seen a lot of demonstrations across the world now, in Paris, the French government deemed the pro-Palestinian protests as illegal and initiated a heavy crackdown on protesters in the French capital. I mean, what exactly does this mean when Israel can commit atrocities and nothing is being said officially, but when the French people want to protest against these crimes, the French government labels their act as illegal?
Well, it just shows you who really runs the French government. It's no different than my country. America is run by basically AIPAC and other Zionist organizations and lobbies. So it's no surprise to me that the West sits back and allows this to happen to these people in Gaza and Palestine and do nothing about it. And again, as Yusuf said, a lot of empty words, a lot of empty promises and condolences and all these things, but that doesn't change anything. We need to see action. We need to see solidarity. We need to see some sanctions at least. I mean, imagine if the United States said, we're going to have to sanction you for that, but they'll never do it. So we need to really pressure Israel with sanctions and other ways to punish them for their behavior, because right now they have a blank check to do whatever they want. They're very confident that they can kill civilians disproportionately with no response whatsoever from any other country. That's why they do it. They have no fear of loss. But as Yusuf said, the Palestinians actually broke through their Iron Dome. And now there's something that they have to worry about. And I condemn all violence on all sides, of course, because I don't want to see any innocent civilians killed. However, the Israelis simply don't care about innocent civilians. It would be different if they were targeting militants only. But they just kill everyone. It's a collective punishment, and it's been going on for decades. And that's why people are starting to back the Palestinians from all over the world. And it disgusts me that the French government wants to make this illegal for the French people who have some kind of decency to say something. To make that an illegal protest is absolutely insane and shows you who runs the French government.
Hmm. Well, Yusuf, if what is happening in Gaza was to happen in New York or London or Paris, I mean, what type of reaction would we see? And we've seen Israel target residential areas, even high-rise buildings, and kill many kids and others in this very densely populated area. I just want to talk about that side of things, the difference. What is it? Is it that a Palestinian life in these Western eyes or less, or your assessment of it all?
Yes, unfortunately, this is the norm. If this happened to Israelis, probably the whole world would have intervened. If Palestinians attack a Jewish synagogue in Jerusalem, the whole world would have condemned it. But when a holy site, Al-Aqsa Mosque, was violated, attacked, you know, over and over and over again, the world is not reacting. It's because it doesn't belong to what's called the Jewish state. I mean, Israel is trying to portray itself as a Jewish state. Israel is trying to grab more land, and they say the land is too small to be shared. That's why Netanyahu keeps saying that he will never allow the establishment of Palestinian state. So obviously, Palestinian blood is cheap, and I can't understand the psychology behind a human being who is enjoying and sitting on top hills and say to the Israeli occupation forces, pound Gaza, and they chant slogans, death to Arab, whereas they don't even know that there are some Jews Arabs. So there is something wrong with the psychology, with the mentality here.
Well, let's look at that. I want to cross over because I don't have that much time. Back with Angelo, Yusuf said there's something with the psychology there. I want to talk about the psychology beyond that area. Again, back to these various Western governments, because I talked earlier about Paris and not allowing the demonstration to take place, pro-Palestinian demonstration. There's Austria that's flying Israeli flags in its office buildings in support of what Israel is doing. London and of course, Washington is just quiet. And then, of course, we have Germany that has also sided with the Israeli regime. So it's one thing what Yusuf was saying inside of Israel and, unfortunately, their disconnect with reality. But how do you assess these Western governments? Why is this the case? Why isn't a Palestinian life of value, or should I say, why is an Israeli life of so much value? It appears even more than their own nationals.
Oh, yes, it's insane to know that's the truth when it comes to this, because, first of all, the Zionist regime has infiltrated all media in the West, and they're always telling people Israel's our greatest ally, and this goes for every one of these Western countries. And they have also made the communities in the Middle East seem like they're always the bad guys, whether it comes to Gaddafi, Saddam, the Palestinians, the Syrians. They have demonized Muslims in general as well. So you see here that we have to stop the Muslims, and they did 9/11 and all this other stuff like that, and that gives this nonchalant disregard for their lives. And Israel's our only democracy. It's our only ally in the Middle East. We have to protect them. They're the only ones like us, when in reality, they're the complete opposite of us. They don't even share the same value of life at all. And also, the idea of the Palestinians' life being less than other people's lives comes from the extremists in Israel, the Zionists, who are the Talmudic Zionists, like Rabbi Osef Yabardia, who basically said that a Gentile life is like cattle. And this kind of spreads throughout the West when you demonize Muslims and Palestinians and other people. So when these rockets are flown, oh, it's those evil Muslims going at it. Meanwhile, there's Christians in Palestine. So the West is ignorant because the Zionists have much influence in Western media, and this trickles down into the governments, and the governments repeat these mantras that Israel's our greatest ally, we must support them no matter what, at the expense of their own people. Like Nancy Pelosi has said, if anything, even if our country crumbles, my country, United States, we will always support Israel. It's insane that these are our representatives, and this is all over the West. So I am not surprised that these people do not value Palestinian lives when they should absolutely value them.
Well, Yusuf, we've seen Muslims in neighboring countries of Palestine express their solidarity, even countries such as Jordan, and we witness people going to the border, and of course Lebanon the same way. And there seems to be a growing awareness, especially in these neighboring countries, and showing strong solidarity with their Palestinian brothers. I want to talk about the significance of that on the Israeli psyche, that they know that the Palestinians really are not alone.
Indeed, it was unprecedented to see thousands of hundreds of thousands of Jordanians or Lebanese reaching Washington or the border and even trying to infiltrate the border. And it was a standoff. Israeli soldiers were carrying Israeli flags, trying to provoke those Jordanians, who mostly Palestinians, who were kicked out from their homes back in 1948. This was also kind of something new. We never witnessed such a scenery that those people dare and managed and they infiltrated the border to show solidarity with their Palestinian brothers and sisters. It was something new. It raises our morale, the Palestinians' morale. You know, they know that they are not alone anymore in this aggression. There is no equal sides in this. I wouldn't say it's conflict; it's an attack against people. So when these people in neighboring countries, Egyptians, whatever is their nationality, of course they will react. It's an awakening, and the Israelis are worried from this because they have been trying hard to disconnect Palestinians from the regional, you know, existence, and they have been trying their best in order to disconnect and dislink those Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank from their, you know, Palestinians inside the green light. So what's happening is something we haven't witnessed before. And I can tell you something, Mardia, that whatever Israel does, Palestinians will never raise the white flag. They will continue to resist. They will keep rising from the ashes until their lands are liberated. And Israel has been pinning its hope on the new generations because an Israeli prime minister at the time, Golda Meir, she said this phrase that the old will die and the young will forget. But it's not happening. The young are remembering. We teach the love of our homeland to our children. And those young people who rely nowadays on social media, they are not afraid anymore. You can see these Palestinian youth in Jerusalem. They front and face Israeli soldiers, you know, whatever their means available. So the conflict will not be resolved until Palestinian rights are regained.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this debate. Journalist and documentary filmmaker Yusuf Al-Hadou out of London, editor of New Frontier USA.org.